Hello, and thanks for joining us on Chicago Tonight, Black Voices. I'm Brandis Friedman. Here's what we're looking at. The White House is rescinding its memo that froze federal funding following confusion and legal action.
Because we built this nation, but we got nothing back from it.
An effort to hold companies complicit in slavery to account. Advocates are pushing back against President Trump's executive order to scale back transgender protections. And were you ever told to stay away from Chicago's South and West Sides? You're not alone. A new book explores the impact of that message. And now to some of today's top stories. The Trump administration is rescinding a memo freezing federal funding following massive backlash. The White House Office of Management and Budget rescinded its memo less than 2 days after calling for a pause on federal grants, which sparked widespread confusion and legal challenges. The freeze threatened to hold up trillions of dollars in funding for basic government functions like health care, infrastructure, and support for children and veterans. In remarks made before the reversal was announced, Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker today reacted to the backlash the Trump administration was receiving.
I'm pretty sure that they received a message yesterday from across the country that this is a bad idea. Fine, review all the programs. Let's make sure we're doing it efficiently and effectively. But don't shut off the programs while you're reviewing them.
The White House says while the memo was pulled today, Trump's underlying executive orders targeting federal spending in areas like diversity, equity, and inclusion and climate change remained in place. The fate of former House Speaker Michael Madigan is now in the hands of a jury, 113 days after the landmark trial began. Madigan is charged, along with his longtime right-hand man, Michael McLean, with racketeering, bribery, and wire fraud. Prosecutors say the men orchestrated multiple corruption schemes, wielding Madigan's immense political power to reward his loyal allies and enrich himself. Madigan's defense team, however, argues he never solicited nor received any bribes related to his official office or his private law firm. They have each pleaded not guilty. If you're a homeowner in Cook County, your property tax bill is on its way. It's the second time since 2021 Cook County officials are sending out the bills on time. That means property owners must pay their first installment no later than March 4th. To see how your bill is calculated, please visit our website. And the Lunar New Year is kicking off today. Community members were celebrating the Year of the Snake with events across the city. The Year of the Snake symbolizes rebirth, regeneration, and the pursuit of love and happiness. The Lunar New Year Parade is in Chicago's Chinatown neighborhood is set for Sunday, February 9th. For more on the holiday and how it's celebrated, please check out our website. Up next, new legislation addresses businesses' historic ties to slavery right after this.
Chicago Tonight, Black Voices, is made possible in part by the support of these donors.
Evanston in 2021 became the first city in the U.S. to implement a reparations program for black residents. While Illinois has a commission to study reparations, another proposed state law sets Illinois on a path to something similar. Our Amanda Vinicky joins us now with more. Amanda.
Yes, Brenda. State Representative Sonia Harper is the sponsor of what she calls the Enslavement Era Disclosure and Redress Act. It's a way, she says, for companies that profited from slavery to help repair the legacy of harm it's caused for generations of black Americans.
Black Americans, we have waited so long. We have waited so long in vain for our communities to be made whole. After hundreds of years of repression and oppression on so many levels, we've waited long enough.
So, Amanda, what exactly would the bill do?
It would require companies that want to do business with the slave that state that participated in either slaveholding or the slave trade to say so, be it whether they transported enslaved people on trains, provided loans for the purchase of enslaved people, or otherwise profited. They would have to file this information with the state when submitting a bid for a state contract. As part of the bid, companies would also have to provide a statement of financial redress. In other words, the amount of money they're they're committing to pay. The bill says that it is a way for corporations to take responsibility for past actions and to demonstrate their commitment to fostering a more just and equitable society. Backers say people, companies, and governments got rich because of slavery. Meanwhile, when slavery was abolished in 1865, enslaved people were left with next to nothing, and they're still trying to catch up.
You are not giving us a handout. You're giving us what is deserved to those who are descendants of the enslaved. And no policy that we pass in this building will ever close the economic gap that went on for 400 years. We will not close the educational gap that went on for 150 years before we even got access to education.
Amanda, how much would companies have to pay?
That's not explicitly spelled out in the bill. It's among the various details that have yet to be worked out. But that money would be put into a special state fund used not for direct reparations, but for projects in economically depressed areas that were hurt by redlining or Jim Crow era policies.
So what are the bill's chances, Amanda?
That is hard to tell. It's really early in the legislative session, but yes, it is going to get some pushback. I did try to reach out to some likely opponents, did not have any luck. That includes Judicial Watch, an organization behind a lawsuit arguing that Evanston's program is unconstitutional based on equal protection grounds. Creating a slavery-era disclosure bill, however, is a law, by law that is, one of the missions of a state reparations commission that was created in the wake of George Floyd's murder. That commission has been on a statewide listening tour, and its next stop is coming to the Chicago area. It will be holding a listening tour hearing. Residents welcome to give their input in Evanston a week from Saturday. That's February 8th.
All right, Amanda, thanks so much.
Mm-hmm.
And you can read Amanda's full story on our website. It's all at WTTW.com/news. President Donald Trump's flurry of executive orders includes rolling back protections for transgender people. Advocates are pushing back, saying there could be a domino effect of widespread consequences. Here with more are Shannon Parker, CEO of Brave Space Alliance, Alethea Zamatakis, research assistant professor at the Institute for Sexual and Gender Minority Health and Well-being at Northwestern University, and on Zoom, Precious Brady Davis, a commissioner for the Metropolitan Water Reclamation District of Chicago. Ladies, thanks to all of you for joining us. Shannon Parker, I want to start with you, please. Brave Space Alliance,
yes.
Black-led, trans-led, LGBTQ nonprofit. Mm-hmm. How do you think this order will impact federal funding that supports organizations like yours?
Oh, what a great question. So again, thank you for having me today. A devastating effect. So many of the organizations similar to Brave Space Alliance that provide affirming care, life-saving care to gender-expansive populations are heavily reliant on government grants, namely federal funding. So when we have executive orders such as these, they strike at the heart. They cut off the life's blood of organizations that do this life-saving work every day. And I really want to be clear that this affects more than just LGBTQ or trans-serving organizations. It affects organizations that serve marginalized populations across the gamut. So yes, it has a huge detriment on the organizations such as mine.
Yeah. Precious Brady Davis, take us back, if you would, a little bit to the history of policing of non-gender conforming people or gender non-conforming people.
When we look at the birth of our movement at Stonewall, we see two brave brown and black trans women. We see Marsha P. Johnson. We see Sylvia Rivera, who pushed back against the policing of folks who were gender variant. For years, the LGBTQ community, in particular the trans community, have organized in the spirit of authenticity. This is not the first time that we have been policed. We saw our lives policed during the Reagan administration, when the Reagan administration did not stand up for HIV, did not fight for a cure. We saw Don't Ask, Don't Tell during the Clinton administration, and then on to George President Bush. So I think that we've lived it during these times before, and I think that we as trans people, I think that we are resilient people.
The trans community, fairly small, making up only 1% of our entire population. Commissioner, why do you think this administration sees this community as a threat?
I think that we as trans people, that we make up 1% of the population, as you say, approximately 3 million Americans. Does that mean that our lives don't matter? Approximately 3 million people live in the state of Iowa. And I find it as a distraction. I think it's really a distraction about the 1% who this president is catering to. We saw at the president's inauguration the tech oligarchs, the folks who were going to benefit from the tax cuts of this administration. And it's an attack, it's a distraction, and we're going to be fighting back tooth and nail.
Alethea Zamitakis, Trump's definition of gender in this order is the biological sex you are assigned at birth. What do you think is wrong with that definition?
Yeah, I mean, not only is it inaccurate as to the understanding of ourselves as transgender people, but it's also scientifically inaccurate. The executive order argues that a male is someone with the chromosomal material of a male at conception, but we all have the chromosomal material of males and females at conception. So by this definition, essentially we're all males and females. But I think the point really isn't to have a sound definition of gender within this order. It is to lay the basis for these attacks and, as the commissioner said, to provide an immense amount of distraction and division among people.
That said, what impact could it have on legal documentation for trans people, on your federal your passport, for example?
Yeah, it will ultimately prohibit transgender people from having access to passports and other legal documentation that represents their accurate gender markers and names. Already transgender people have had their passport applications either denied or even held at this time without even being returned since Trump's executive order. This will also make it more difficult for precarious situation with documents. Trans people often carry a driver's license with one gender and a birth certificate with another and so forth because it's so difficult for us to get accurate documents. This will only exacerbate that problem. It'll also make it more difficult for us to actually know what's happening to trans people. So when trans people are killed, it's really hard for us to know how often that happens because there's a lack of data. And now,
and if they are misidentified by the authorities at the time.
Exactly.
Shannon, you worked at the Cook County Department of Corrections, specifically populations in protective custody. What's at stake for trans women or trans people who are incarcerated?
So much is at stake. Having worked in the Cook County Department of Corrections as the first openly transgender woman, I helped to shape and inform many policies that are still in place today to create protections for such a vulnerable population. This flies in the face of a federal mandate called PREA, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, and that act actually is undergirded to protect the population that's now being attacked. So what we see, what we're gonna see if we're not seeing it already, is the movement of protected individuals who are right now detained or incarcerated in facilities that are in alignment with their internal reality, being sent to male prisons, jails, where they could be attacked in multiple ways, if not killed.
Precious Brady Davis, will this impact any Illinois laws, state laws that protect trans rights?
I'm so glad that we live in the land of Lincoln. LGBTQ rights reign supreme. Here in Illinois, LGBTQ education is taught in schools. My husband and I, we took on this state to ensure that folks can be identified properly on birth certificates as the gender that they identify as. We were the first couple in the state to do that. I'm proud that we have a progressive legislature and we have a progressive governor. I was the first Black trans woman appointed to public office in Cook County history, appointed by our governor. And our governor has said that he's going to fight back and that you have to come through him to get through the people of Illinois. And so my heart breaks for the people across the country who don't live in a blue state. My heart breaks for the trans youth who won't receive gender-affirming care. And it's important that Illinois will become a beacon of reproductive justice and care during this time.
Yeah, of course, you mentioned the trans youth and their care, because we know that Trump has signed another executive order banning teens and adolescents from accessing that health care. Shannon, back to you. Are Black trans women at higher risk of being targeted when their rights are threatened like this?
Absolutely. You know, Black trans women lived at multiple intersections, race, identity, some being more visible than others. And what we see is carte blanche emboldenment of individuals who, when the highest office of the land actually gives a pass for individuals to threaten, demean, tear down the humanity of another individual, it goes without saying that there is an emergency for trans women.
And before we run, speaking of an emergency, we've got about 30 seconds. Alethea, I'm going to let you have the last word. What is your advice to trans people and families right now?
Yeah, I think transgender people need to fight back. We need to be organized and in the streets. We've seen with immigrant rights that we've been able to make it so difficult for them to be able to deport anyone because of organizing and spreading the word and informing people. We need to do the same with transgender people.
Okay, that's where we have to leave it. Thanks to the three of you for joining us. Shannon Parker, Alethea Zamatakis, and Precious Brady Davis. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Up next, a book on disrupting segregation. Stay with us. Told to stay away from the south or west sides of Chicago? That was the question posed to local residents, and responses poured in about times they were told, don't go. Those stories are now compiled in a new book called Don't Go, Stories of Segregation and How to Disrupt It, to better understand what can happen when people explore the ignored parts of the city. Joining us now are the book's co-authors, artist, photographer Tanika Lewis Johnson, and sociologist Maria Creason. Thanks to you both for joining us. Welcome back to Chicago Tonight.
Thank you.
So this book starts with your own personal stories of growing up and then how you came together to write this book. How does your story reflect the experiences of the people that you included? Maria Creason, I'll start with you.
So not very much. I think that's part of the interesting part of the story between Tanika and I is we had extremely different upbringings. I grew up in a small town in South Dakota where there were three Black people. So we did not have the kinds of issues of segregation. It was a small town. So my upbringing was very different than Tanika's, and that's kind of part of the point of the inclusion of these stories, is that two people with very different backgrounds but having very similar other experiences. We both loved to read. We both had family with artists in them. You know, we had lots of similarities, and yet we're both nerds. Okay, you were going to say it? All right, you say it.
You said it, not me. Tanika, same question to you. How do you think it's important, or why do you think it's important to include your own stories in this story?
Well, one, I wanted people who read this book to understand that this is what segregation prevents you from being able to do. It keeps you from people that you have a shared passion with, that you have a common interest with. And when you come together, you can create a book like Don't Go. And so it was really important for people to understand that even though Marie and I have very different backgrounds, we have a shared passion and interest to help educate people on how to disrupt segregation. And this was our way of demonstrating that. And so it's an example of what can happen when you disrupt segregation.
When you ask people to share their Don't Go stories, of course, you received a lot of responses. Maria, what did that tell you?
That Tonika, once again, had really struck a chord. I tell people I'm a sociologist, and I, for years, have tried to get people to talk to me to do surveys and interviews and focus groups, and I have to bribe them and cajole them and persuade them
coffee.
To do it. And so when I opened the inbox that showed all of the responses that Tonika had generated just by mentioning it on social media, I was like, okay, well, this is a lot easier than anything I've ever done.
Yeah,
and it was, the stories were amazing.
It speaks to her following as
Correct.
Well. Tonika, what's wrong with the don't go narrative when people hear, oh, don't go into that neighborhood? What's wrong with that?
Well, one, especially when you're in a segregated city like Chicago, and people say don't go to the south side of Chicago, and the south side of Chicago is majority black because of our history of redlining. And when people say that, it shows that they're not educated on how that came to be and how it perpetuates segregation. So it's just a common rumor, and businesses know that. People who are interested in buying homes know that. So you're literally stifling black neighborhoods by just saying something just so common like don't go to the south side, because it really does prevent investment.
It's also offensive to the thousands and thousands of people who call those neighborhoods home.
Personally offensive, and that's the other part that I think we really wanted to show with this book is the personal part of segregation. It's not just that it prevents economic investment, it hurts people's feelings and it helps people live in fear. And we wanted to offer an opportunity for people to understand how to disrupt that and how to not be offensive to people.
Maria, what are some of the themes that emerged from these stories?
Oh, so many themes.
I know,
fear.
Which
themes do we pick?
Fear.
I mean, fear was the predominant theme, and it was fear of being shot and killed. You know, that's what we heard from many white people that we talked to, who talked about the message that they were got, that they were received either growing up from their parents or families or police officers sometimes or coworkers or colleagues or college student friends, things like that. Everyone is instilling this fear. So that was really, that's kind of the motif that goes through all of it. Mm-hmm. It's also fear of being embarrassed to talk about these kind of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of why we really wanted to do this book, is to show people you can confront these fears. The thoughts and fears that you have are shared by others, and people could see themselves in the book and say, oh, now I see they overcame their fears and did something
and
different.
Once they conquer that fear, and maybe they do go to visit a neighborhood on the south or the west mm-hmm. side, what do they learn?
Oh, that's the beautiful part that I love about the book, is that this book in particular, since we have stories of white Chicagoans, black Chicagoans, Latino Chicagoans, it really does help people understand how segregation impacts all of us. And the fear that we're talking about, you know, a lot of white Chicagoans are expressing the vulnerability of admitting that they have been taught to be raised in that fear. And so one of the revelations that they have is, oh, it's not what I've been taught, and it is actually racist. And then also we have people who are from neighborhoods that people are told to not go to, like Tiana, and her story is very much like mine. She had to learn that that's what people thought of her neighborhood, and that was eye-opening for her.
Why is this kind of storytelling important? How does storytelling help disrupt segregation?
I think that as a sociologist who spent her career crunching numbers, analyzing texts, and reducing them to reports that academics and policymakers read, I think the stories touch us in a way that Tonika always talks about, until we make segregation personal, we're never going to break it down. And I think what better way than through stories to help people see the really what's going on, the impact of the messaging, I just think stories are relatable.
And it seems to me, Tanika, it also is sort of people taking it into their own hands rather than waiting on government to fix segregation. Yes.
Oh, yes, because clearly politics and policies haven't gotten us to where we want to be, and I personally believe is because we forget that it's personal. Racism is rooted in people to people, and it's really personal, and that's the part that we want to elevate and bring back, that you can disrupt these large systemic issues by, you know, changing behaviors, your personal behaviors, or just thinking about the history of all of these issues. And it really is how you treat people. It just comes down to that.
All right. Lessons to be learned. Sounds like a good book to get our hands on.
Yes.
That is where we'll have to leave it. My thanks to Tanika Lewis-Johnson and Maria Creason for joining us. Thanks.
Thank
Congratulations
you.
On the book.
Thanks.
Again, the book is called Don't Go, Stories of Segregation and How to Disrupt It. And that is our show for this Wednesday night. Be sure to sign up for our free email newsletter, The Daily Chicagoan, at WTTW.com/newsletter. And join us tomorrow night at 5:30 and 10. We have the latest on how federal immigration raids are impacting local communities. Now, for all of us here at Chicago Tonight Black Voices, I'm Brandis Friedman. Thank you for watching. Stay healthy and safe, and have a good night.
Closed captioning is made possible by Robert A. Clifford and Clifford Law Offices, a Chicago personal injury and wrongful death firm, and proud sponsor of programming that offers advice and strategies to enhance the physical and mental well-being of fellow legal practitioners in Illinois.